Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Steve Shiagi. My registration number is 33298. And with me at council table is Marissa Hudson Arney, who is also on the briefs. And she reminded me that her registration number is 33261. And we represent the appellants in this action. We are here, Your Honors, on this lawsuit that was filed under the Colorado Open Records Act based upon some roadblocks that we unfortunately ran into that were thrown up by the Metro District, which is called Parker Jordan Metro District. And what is critical for the court to understand is while the Metro District provided documents to my clients in response to CORA request, it utterly refused to produce a single email to my clients under those CORA requests until it was ordered to do so by the district court in an order of April 30th, 2012. So just so the record is clear, that what we're dealing with here in this appeal is the emails that we had to file a lawsuit to have the Metro District produced.
May I ask counsel, have some of those emails now been produced
in response
to the court's order?
They have. In fact, Your Honor, we received 3,500 pages of emails on May 25th of last year, so that was about 7 months after our CORA request. We received another 380 documents on July 13th of last year, and then the final set was roughly, I believe, if my math is good, about 1,200 extra pages, the final pages of emails on July 19th of last year. So those dates are all, we're talking almost 10 months after our CORA request.
So are we only talking about the documents that you have already received, or are we also talking about documents you still believe you should receive?
We're talking about both, Your Honor.
Okay.
Which actually leads me to the first issue I wanted to raise with Your Honors, and that was actually the last issue of our briefing, which is the mandatory attorney's fees provision of the CORA statute. As Your Honors are aware, the district court in Arapahoe County, Judge Pratt, declined to award my clients any attorney's fees at all, even though we prevailed on summary judgment to the extent the order required the Metro District to provide us attorney's fees, or I'm sorry, to provide us emails. And the district court's determination that it would not require an award of fees is that it determined that the district did not violate the statute when it demanded these upfront fees before it would do anything. So that's the basis on which the district court denied our request for fees. Now, as the court is aware, CORA has a very, very strongly worded mandatory attorney's fees provision, particularly when there's a prevailing applicant. And Judge Terry, you wrote the Colorado Republican Party decision that we're going to talk about today. That statute, which is CRS 2472-204 sub 5, says that a court shall award court costs and reasonable attorney's fees to a prevailing applicant.
Now, counsel, I have a question for you, though. If we were to conclude that the trial court was correct, that it was okay to require an upfront deposit before producing the requested documents, would there still then be would there still be a violation of the statute that would entitle you to fees?
I think that's a good question, and my answer is absolutely yes, Your Honor. And the reason is there are emails that Parker Jordan, the Metro District, never argued are not subject to the statute. There are emails, if you recall, there is briefing in the court below about whether or not it's the receipt of the emails is the issue that would trigger disclosure, or whether if the issue is whether or not those emails were relied upon by Clifton Larson, which is the Metro District's agent, essentially, or the subcontractors. There are emails that the board, that the Metro District never produced, that were clearly subject to the statute on which it was copied, that it never provided to us until the order was issued in April. Those emails.
Where would we look in the record to find out what you're telling us now, that those were withheld and they weren't subject to the deposit situation?
You can look at the briefing, the summary judgment briefing, Your Honor. In fact, the Metro District summary judgment response brief at page 5 makes the argument that it need not produce emails on the servers on which it was not copied. So, and we argued in our summary, in our reply summary judgment brief, Your Honor, that that is a tacit admission that emails that the district was copied on should have been produced.
And there were some of those emails that were ultimately produced after the court's order?
Yes.
Is there anything in the record that indicates that? Because I'm concerned that you may be relying on something outside the record, which we're not entitled to look at.
What I would rely on, Your Honor, is obviously the 5,000 plus pages of emails that are received, several months after the order was issued.
Are those is there somewhere in the record that indicates that?
There is not, Your Honor. There is not. I would obviously state to you as an officer of court that that is what happened. At a minimum, though, Your Honor, if the court were to award attorney's fees and costs to my client, that is certainly something, in accordance with the Colorado Republican Party case, that could be addressed and taken up by the district court on remand. Now, Your Honor, in addition to the emails that Parker Jordan never even argued were not subject to disclosure on CORA, there is a whole thousands of pages of emails that were in the possession of Clifton Larson Anderson that after the summary judgment briefing, the district court ordered Parker Jordan to produce to my clients. We think there are at least two reasons why attorney's fees and costs should have been awarded to my clients. In fact, the situation that we ran into in this case is factually on all fours with the Colorado Republican Party case that we've cited in our supplemental authority that we submitted last week. Factually, in that case, there was a CORA request that was made. Some, but not all, of the documents that were requested were required to be produced by the district judge. As a result, attorney's fees in at least some amount should have been awarded. Factually, that is exactly the same situation as our case. In our case, we, by necessity, issued a quite broad CORA request. The reason why we had to issue such a broad CORA request is because the contract that my clients have with Parker Jordan that requires them to produce documents, we were told by the general counsel, certainly not Mr. Brunesky here, but the former general counsel of that company, that they would not produce them under that contract, that we'd have to file a CORA request. And once they made that position, we filed the lawsuit and prevailed. We won the documents they had refused to provide. Now, there's no question that the district court also decided that emails that neither the district or its board members or Clifton Larson were copied on or received, which would include communications amongst the subcontractors on this construction project. Okay, district court decided that those materials need not be produced to my client because it determined that they were not public record because they were not received by the district. Factually, we believe that this case is on all fours with the Colorado Republican Party case, and that on remand, the district court can or may take into account what was requested against what was ultimately required to be produced in determining a proper attorney's fees award.
Excuse me for interrupting. As a condition preceding that, a governmental agency can require the payment of some fee before production, correct? Now here, the trial court authorized $25 an hour, and I don't recall the $2,500 down payment. Was that approved? as a condition before you get emails?
The story is a little bit more nuanced than that, Your Honor. What originally happened is three working days after we issued our first CORE request, yes. So they responded on October 27th, 2011. The district demanded a contract be signed to by my clients.
Oh, about the $16,000.
That was the $16,000.
I understand. They withdrew that or forgave or didn't proceed on that basis.
I would say they changed it after I sent them a letter, but
they had a board of directors meeting. But I'm thinking, insofar as the trial court's concerned, the emails that were produced. What about the $25 an hour?
My clients ultimately paid that fee, Your Honor. I think we worked it out with Mr. Berneski here, and we paid $1,000 or something like that. But to note, the Metro District, admitted in its answer and counterclaims in the district court that it had no policy in place.
Well, I read, yes.
Okay. And I think that is that's an important distinction, because we've seen the Colorado Court of Appeals decision in Black, and in the Citizens case that were both filed against the Southwest Water Metro District. In both of those cases, there was a policy in place requiring that a $25 fee per hour be paid. This district had nothing in place, and I think the factual scenario shows that they were really making it up as they go along, and I think that's a problem.
Mr. Schneege, so what is it you're asking us to do? Can you give me a list of the things you're asking us to do?
There's a number of things, Your Honor. Thank you for asking. We would like an award of an attorney's fees in some amount, whether that be through this court or remand, is what we'd request. We believe that there should be a ruling that the Metro District erred by the district court erred by allowing the district to require an upfront fee before it does anything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's allowed under the statute, and it certainly is extending the Black decision beyond what we've seen. We would like an order, Your Honor, reversing the district court's decision holding that the communications amongst the subcontractors need not be produced. We think the question is not receipt of emails, it is whether or not those emails were used by the district in its function, in its public function in the construction project in this case. And I'll give you an example as to that. There are, I can't say for certainty, but I'm going to guess, there are going to be emails amongst subcontractors that were never copied to the district or never copied to Clifton and Anderson Larson that will discuss, I mean, we all know how construction projects work. They will discuss advice or counsel or guidance that was given by the board. And so that is precisely why the statute defines a public record as the way it does. It does not define a public record as a document based upon who receives it or not. It's a document that is public or not based upon the use. And Your Honor, to answer your question, we think that the district court's decision that focuses on receipt of the document should be reversed.
The trial court concluded, based on the fact that the district did not see it or possess it, therefore, they weren't required to try and do something to get them.
That is precisely right. The district court held that if it didn't receive it or if Clifton Larson didn't receive it, it could not have been used for a public purpose. And I take issue with that.
Well, counsel, isn't it a little precipitous or too early to determine whether there were documents of the category that you just mentioned until you see a privilege log? And we don't even know if there are documents of that type.
We don't know. And I admittedly am only guessing that those documents exist. The problem is, I don't know. And the additional problem is, it's the last issue on which I asked the court to reverse the district court's decision. The district court, as you're aware, held that it is incumbent on my clients to pay for the district's decision whether or not to make a privilege log. And so that fee would have been many, many, many thousands of dollars. That's a lot of work, I admit it. But as a result, my clients couldn't pay for that, and we don't know what's been withheld. That is the.
This is the first Open Records Act case where I've seen where anybody's requested a privilege log. Have you found any?
I have not found any cases on point, Your Honor. I would refer the court to the statute, of course, which does not permit them to ask for fees for preparing a privilege log. But what I would ask the court to take into account is the balancing that the court must do, balancing the right of a district to be compensated for its time versus the overriding goal, overarching goal of the statute, which is to make public documents available. I seem about to slightly over. If the court has any more questions, I'd certainly be happy to address them.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, members of the court. I'm Joseph Brunesky, and I'm appearing on behalf of Parker Jordan Metro District by number 7973. On Sunday coming up, our brethren of the cloth will start talking about being a doubting Thomas and what that means. And I think we all remember the gospel about that. And what I'm asking you to do is to be a doubting Thomas today, because you have been told things about the record which just aren't so. If you look at the district court's opinion, it appears at page 223 of the record, particularly pages 5 and 10, it shows that Judge Pratt got it. He understood that my client's position was, we'll produce documents to you. In fact, we'll give you more than what we're required to do, provided that you guarantee that you'll pay us $25 an hour and you'll pay a deposit of $2,500. So we were not refusing to produce documents. We were establishing procedures for that. And shortly I'll get back to the regulations and the statutes which allow that.
So let me understand, because part of Mr. Shiaghi's argument is that the court did not require you to produce documents among your contractors. And were you prepared and planning to produce documents that were exchanged among your contractors?
Yes. No, but we took the position in the summary judgment proceedings that we didn't have to do that because of the IBEW case, which our amicus friends rely upon and we rely upon. So we were willing to go even more than the extra mile on that. And here's why.
But at this point, apart from that you were willing to, at this point, it would appear that the court's order does not require you to.
That's
and Mr. Shiaghi says that's error, that the court should be requiring you to produce those. And your position is the court was correct.
Yes. Let me tell you why. We use Clifton Larson Allen as our administrator, and they, in essence, run the district. If we want to get documents from them, from an IT professional, it's going to cost us well over $100 per hour. All we can collect is $25 under the prevailing case law. So we're taking a risk before we go out and incur all those expenses, and our taxpayers incur that. And a deposit is a good way of showing that this is a bona fide good request.
So let me make sure I understand. So before the court entered its ruling, you were willing to produce those documents, but you required this deposit and this $25 an hour. And their argument now is that was improper for you to request that money, that you don't have the right to do that.
That's correct.
And the second part of their argument is that the court's order is erroneous as to the scope of what you are required to produce.
It's erroneous. Our cross appeal deals with what we can charge for as part of our production.
Well, I understand, but Mr. Shiaghi's arguing that the court erred when it said you didn't have to produce it among your contractors. Do you have an argument with regard to that?
Certainly, and here's why. The policy behind the Public Records Act, as enunciated back in 1967 when they wrote the statute, was to prevent secrecy among government actors, your bureaucrats, your legislators, or what have you. And because of that, the idea was if the government makes a decision, citizens should have the right to find out what that decision was based upon. And so essentially, how the case law has worked out is that if the government has access to a document, if the government looks at a document, if the government consults a document, then it is a public record. But documents that are private, that are not part of the decision-making process, are not public records under the statute. There's a number of cases that say that. The Ritter case with the cell phone records. They were obviously maintained by the governor of the state of Colorado. They obviously had something to do with his calls to people while you transacted business, but they were not available to anybody else. They were not used to make decisions, so therefore the Supreme Court said they're not public records. Same thing with the diary in Montrose County.
Well, now those cases are both involving individuals who work for the government. But in this case, what we have is you have a contractor proceeding on your behalf, and they are engaging with other parties on your behalf. Why is it that your agent's documents are not public records?
Because they are maintained by a private contractor as part of the private contractor's business. Where am I going to get the gasoline for my trucks? How many trucks am I going to have on the job? What workers am I going to have on the job?
What about their communications with the city of Centennial that are in furtherance of your goals?
What the plaintiffs in this case can do is go to the city of Centennial and serve an open records request.
Well, they certainly can, but that doesn't mean they can't get them from you.
It does, because they're not part of the decisions that were made by the Parker Jordan board. Let me give you a good
example. So public records require that someone have used the records, used the document to make a decision.
Yes.
And so if there is a public record, if there's a record in your files, nobody looked at, nobody used it to make a decision, you don't have to produce it.
We didn't take that position because...
Is that your argument now?
No, it is not.
Okay, so...
Because it's kind of like a presumption. If it's in your possession, you know about it. And frankly, if we started to split hairs and say, oh, we didn't look at it, that'd be a tough call to make. The best way to look at this is the IBEW case versus the baseball stadium district. There you had a subcontractor that was submitting financial information to the general contractor. Now, the labor union came along and said, boy, oh boy, we'd like to get information about this subcontractor because the next time we negotiate a contract, we want to show how fat and rich they are. The only reason why those documents were public records was because the baseball stadium district actually looked at them.
An employee of the district.
Yes, so an employee of the district, and it was used as part of the district's determination to approve the general contract and also approve Riviera Electric as a subcontractor.
So your argument is that because that case said that an employee looked at it, therefore it is a public record, you draw from that, if an employee doesn't look at it, then therefore it is not a public record.
That's correct. If it's in the hands of a private contractor, in this case a general contractor for the stadium, and the public entity has nothing to do with it, then it's not a public record.
And of course, the request was not made to the public agency in the IBEW case. They didn't go to the same stadium district and ask for the document. They went to Riviera.
No, they went to the district, and then Riviera intervened as a part. Okay. But their only target there was, as it could have been, or as it should have been under the Open Records Act, was the district itself. And consider the implications. Let's suppose that there was this rule that Mr. Shaggy is talking about. And let's suppose a subcontractor says, no, ain't going to produce them. Or I'll produce them if you give me $100 per hour for doing it. Or, no, these are my lawyer's documents. You can't look at them. And I'm the defendant in the case, and he's asking me for fees, and I can't produce the documents because of the resistance I'm getting. That just doesn't work.
Well, that's, I understand. I guess I would say I'm not persuaded that you don't have an obligation first to ask for them, and second, then to get rejected, and then to determine whether you have a remedy or you both have a remedy against the contractor. My concern is this. If the contractor is doing your business and is pulling permits or submitting drawings or whatever, and they're doing it for you, how is it that those are not yours?
Because they are documents compiled by an independent contractor, a private party,
On your behalf.
Prosecution of his work. And the issue of where he buys gas or who he puts on the job is a lot different from what the contract price is that he negotiates with my client or what the job schedule is that he negotiates.
We can, I would understand that there are some documents that maybe would not be discoverable, but from that argument, it seems to me you're saying nothing that is in the possession of your agent is producible under CORA. And excuse me, but to the extent you're saying because they're buying gasoline is not persuasive, to the extent that they are doing work on your behalf with third parties on your behalf, why is that not a public record? Why are they, are they your agents or not?
They are the agents in a limited regard. They are agents for accomplishing the work. They are not agents for holding on to our documents and being the custodian of public documents. And you'll remember that when CORA was enacted in 1967, the legislature said, look, you've got a dichotomy here between public records and public information and privacy. And how this contractor goes about his work is really private information. And that's essentially what the IBEW case is all about. And despite the fact that you had private actors in both the Ritter case and the Whip versus Communications, the key of that case was those documents were not used for public decisions. And that's what CORA is aiming at.
So IBEW says they weren't made for public decisions, and your position is they must, the flip side of that, that therefore if they weren't, then they're therefore not public records.
Well, to be a little bit more crisp, in the IBEW case, they were made available to a public entity for its decision making. And that's what the key is all about. Let me talk a little bit about the statute, though. I looked today before I came here to find out how many electronic records cases there were. There was a tax data case back in 1991, and then there was the Tracy Baker case, the emails in Arapahoe County where he and his girlfriend were messing around.
About a marital affair.
Yeah, that's right. And Rocky Mountain was just love island. But other than that, there really aren't any decisions dealing with how you answer and what you must do with an electronic documents request. And I think there are three statutes which are applicable to it. All of them, of course, are in Article 24, Title 24, Article 72. One is Section 203.1b. And that's the one that the Southwest Water Conservation District cases relied upon. And they said that you can impose rules and regulations which are necessary for the protection of documents. And essentially, that is where the research and retrieval fees that are part of this case come from. The next one, which is, I think, tangentially related and really relates back to the questioning of the court, deals with the issue of privilege laws. And in essence, that is Section 204.3a, Roman numeral 4. And that says that if there is, that talks about denying the right of inspection to privileged information. So that means under the statute, you must protect privileged information. And under the first section, then you're entitled to recover fees for doing that. The last one that's applicable is the statute that deals with the generation or manipulation of data. And privilege laws would come under that. And that's Section 205.3. In essence, what the plaintiffs asked for was a privilege log, and that's the creation of a document that doesn't exist in the district or practically anywhere else. And what the statute says, if you have to do that, you get to recover your costs for doing that. Now, how does that apply in this case? Number one, a request comes in to my client, Parker Jordan, and the request is produce all the documents that have to do with the development of your property, the stream improvement, what have you. We have the ability and the right under the first statute to retrieve documents. And if we have to have an IT professional do that and charge us $150 an hour, we're going to be able to collect only $25. But that clearly falls within that statute. The second issue is winnowing out the documents that are privileged. And we do that very easily by running search terms like names of lawyers or the word privileged or what have you. The district court said we couldn't incur or recover fees for that, even though that's for the protection of documents, because that's how you identify what might be privileged. Now, I got to admit, I think I caused Judge Pratt to be confused, because I pointed out that Clifton Larson Allen managed 140 metro districts and basically kept all of its materials together. But the point would be, if you run the name of Miller and Associates, the lawyers for the district, whether you have 1 million documents you look at or 1,000 documents, the computer's pretty fast at identifying them. So the last thing you do is you have to produce a privilege log if you want to do it, because the statute does not require a privilege log. It simply says, if you withhold a document, you state the reason. We could say, Mr. Khashoggi, we withheld 114 documents because they're privileged, and that would comply with the statute. But we wanted to go one step further, and we said, okay, we'll give you a privilege log, but under the statute dealing with the manipulation of data, we can recover our actual cost for doing it. Because unfortunately, you got to use a lawyer or a really good paralegal to do that, and they're not $25 an hour. So that's what this is all about. And what I suggest to you is that if you want to break the drought of lack of decisions dealing with electronic data, and you want to write a decision, take a look at those statutes and how they apply to this particular case. So that's it. I think my client was more than accommodating, but just wanted upfront fees. And the district court said, okay, you can charge them. We reduced the fees to $1,000 from $2,500, and then produced, we didn't refuse a single document. We just set up parameters or procedures for doing so.
Mr. Brunesky, let me ask point of clarification. Do I understand correctly that you were not going to charge for the screening process of identifying privileged documents, but you were going to charge for the creation of the privilege log based on that screening?
I'm smiling a little bit, because really that's a complicated issue.
Okay.
Some legal authorities say that the preparation of the privilege log involves the screening step. Some say it is separate and distinct. What I'm saying to you is probably de minimis, because you crank in the name of Miller and Associates, and Peter says, bam, there it is, and you get your result.
All right, and with regard to the privilege log, is it that plaintiffs here requested a privilege log? I mean, you had mentioned this possibility that you could have said, we have withheld 500 documents, but we're going to go one step further and give you a privilege log. Were they asking for that privilege log, or?
In fairness to them, they said, if you are going to withhold any documents, give us a privilege log. And I think they used the word index, but it
so they wanted identified.
Precisely.
Even beyond privilege? I mean, when we say privilege, we're talking about attorney-client, attorney work product, and the statement, if you're going to withhold any documents, would seem to be broader.
It would include the deliberative privilege. It would involve any confidential information of our contractors, and you're correct. All of that does go into a privilege log, but it's for a different reason.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, counsel. This case, now having been argued and briefed, is now submitted for the decision of this court. Cases